Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hey there, it's Chris Bentley, host of Here and Now Anytime. Let me ask you a quick favor. It's easy, but important to me and everyone who works on this show. If you like that we're here every afternoon, bringing you fresh perspectives and insightful conversations on the big stories of the day, take 5 seconds and follow Here and Now Anytime, wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. And if you want to make us really happy and help other people find this show, leave us a good review. It really helps. And thanks. Now here's the show.
Because we have felt like the Democratic Party has taken our communities for granted for so long, it is only the Democratic Party, it is only Joe Biden who would be responsible if he were to lose.
Pro-Palestinian protesters take to the streets. It's Friday, April 19th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, we'll hear from people trying to end homelessness in two smaller cities, Bakersfield, California, and Burlington, Vermont. Also, video game pioneer Jordan Mechner tells a story of survival in a new graphic novel that weaves his personal history with his family's escape from the Nazis.
Being in Europe, kind of on the ground where my dad had been a refugee, where his life had been in danger, where all of these things happened, it all became so much more concrete.
But first, the United Nations Secretary General said today it is high time to stop the dangerous cycle of retaliation in the Middle East. That, of course, comes after Israel launched a limited military strike against Iran in response to Iran's own assault on Israel last weekend, which, of course, was retaliation for Israel's airstrike on an Iranian diplomatic compound earlier this month. The military tit-for-tat between the two longtime enemies has sparked worries that Iran and Israel's shadow war could become a regional crisis, says Steve Hendricks of the Washington Post.
This was calculated to show that Israel could get into the heart of Iran, but we're not doing it tonight.
We've got that whole conversation and more analysis of the military situation at hereandnow.org. But right now, we're going to turn to another aspect of how the regional conflict is affecting people here, and talk to one of the people helping organize pro-Palestinian demonstrations around the U.S. More than 100 students protesting at Columbia University were arrested last night. Earlier this week, demonstrators blocked the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, the Brooklyn Bridge in New York, and the highway leading to O'Hare International Airport in Chicago. Hatem Abudeya is national chair with the U.S.-Palestinian Community Network, based in Chicago. Here's his conversation with Scott Tong.
We saw pro-Palestinian demonstrations ramp up this week, notably in Tax Day, and many protesters described their efforts as an economic blockade on behalf of Palestinians. At the center, is there an economic message here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the main economic message is that we don't want any more of our tax dollars going to be used as it has been, especially in the past 6.5 months, to genocide the Palestinian people in Gaza with over 35,000 who have been killed and probably thousands more that are still under the rubble.
Yeah, I understand. And we should just mention genocide is a contested term. The International Court of Justice is looking at it, says Israel needs to prevent a genocide, and that court has not yet determined that Israel is committed genocide.
But it has determined that it's a plausible genocide.
Yes, I understand. When protesters this week block people from getting to work, block people from catching a flight, does it risk simply making people mad and losing their support?
I actually don't think it does that. What I think it does is it forces people to say, I need to do something about this. We have seen in poll after poll, not only do the majority of the people in the United States want Israel to stop its killing of the Palestinian people, but a majority now actually do believe it is a genocide as well. So what we think is that folks who are watching this, folks who might get caught up in it, are starting to become angry with the people who are in power, like we are, meaning the Democratic Party and the folks who are enabling this and actually are complicit in the genocide as well.
Yeah, and Joe Biden, the president, if these protests in effect weaken the president politically, make it more likely for Donald Trump to get elected, is that a better outcome for you?
Not necessarily a better outcome, but I think at some point, communities like ours, the Palestinian community, because we have felt like the Democratic Party has taken our communities for granted for so long, it is only the Democratic Party, it is only Joe Biden who would be responsible if he were to lose. He is the one who is enabling Israel to do this. He is the one that could turn off that valve of money and weapons to Israel if he wanted to. Instead, he continues to try to send more weapons to Israel to use against our people. And so we will not take any responsibility for Trump winning if he does. The responsibility would be exclusively on Joe Biden and the Democratic Party as a whole.
I want to ask you about the Democratic National Convention this summer. Many listeners will remember the protests at the Democratic National Convention back in 1968. They prompted violent clashes with law enforcement, and the videos are famous. They chanted, "The whole world is watching." What do you want to accomplish this time around, and is there a risk that it could spiral into some violence this summer?
The only risk of violence is if the Chicago police, all the federal, local, and state law enforcement agencies that will be there, if they initiate it. What I know is the whole world will be watching this as well.
As far as achieving what you're trying to achieve policy-wise, any evidence that these protests are actually moving the needle?
Yeah, I think there is. I think that the polls, where the regular American working person is being asked about this, and they want Israel to stop the violence and stop the killing. And the other thing is that my organization specifically has been bird-dogging a number of Democratic Party legislators who we believe are complicit, who continue to support Israel unequivocally, even in the face of all of this slaughter and massacre. Just recently, one of those in Chicago specifically, Congressman Sean Casten, who represents a huge community of Palestinians, has signed a letter saying he is concerned Israel is violating U.S. law by using our weapons and our aid to commit war crimes. Yeah. So I do believe that the needle is moving.
Hatem Abudeya is with the U.S. Palestinian Community Network based in Chicago. Hatem, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the number of homeless people in the U.S. hit a record high in December. It's bad in many cities, big and small. But after the break, Scott will zero in on two places grappling with the problem, what's working and what's still needed. Stick around.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. With thousands of options under $20,000, plus customizable financing terms and down payments as low as $0 down, it's easy to find a car that fits your lifestyle. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today. Terms and conditions may apply.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
The number of homeless people in this country has hit a record high, 653,000 as of December, and that's 12% more than the previous year. Why? Well, federal officials cite high rental prices and the end of pandemic-era assistance. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court hears a case with big implications for how cities manage homelessness. Let's look now at two cities facing this challenge, Bakersfield, California, and Burlington, Vermont. First, in Vermont, the numbers have gone up quickly, and now it has one of the highest homeless rates in the country. With us now is Sarah Russell from Burlington, Vermont. She's the city's special assistant to end homelessness. She also co-chairs the Chittenden County Homeless Alliance. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
For every 1,000 residents in Vermont, I understand five are unhoused. Give us a snapshot of Burlington. What does the human side look like?
In Burlington, we have seen a stark increase in homelessness since the pandemic began. Pre-pandemic, our point-in-time count numbers indicated that about 176 households were experiencing homelessness. That number rose in just 1 year, which brought us to 626 households experiencing homelessness in Chittenden County. Mm. So we continue to see, you know, high rates of homelessness across the county and across Vermont.
Yeah. When you think about the main factors for the homeless challenge in Burlington, what are they?
A couple of things come into play. First, in Burlington and across Chittenden County, we have a vacancy rate of less than 1%, which means that when housing units become available, they're often very expensive, and there could be up to 100 applicants for that one apartment.
So not enough units.
Not enough units at all.
Mm. And they're increasingly unaffordable, given the demand and the scarcity?
Very unaffordable to a large sector of our population. It makes rental assistance critical to folks being able to maintain their housing. We also need to exercise a low barrier and housing first approach to provide people with stability so that they can work on, you know, other goals that they may have.
Mm. Do you have enough in Burlington shelter beds to meet the need? If you don't, what do you do?
We do not, and that's something that we constantly are working on with our nonprofit partners. We have about 200 people within the city who self-identify as living unsheltered within the city, and we employ actually city staff who conduct outreach to folks who are living unsheltered, connecting them to resources, facilities, and services. And we also, parallel to that track, are working very hard to increase shelter capacity across the city.
What are the main ways, Sarah, that Burlington can tackle this? Provide more low-cost rental units? What's in your toolbox?
Well, one of the things that we've been working on through the Chittenden County Homeless Alliance is developing partnerships. We believe that we need both a public sector and private sector partnership in the work to end homelessness. We approach private housing developers and encourage them to enter into agreements with the Homeless Alliance to dedicate some of their units, their housing units, to people exiting homelessness. And that's been a very successful strategy for us. We need more housing production, and we also at the same time need that to be permanently affordable housing, and we need those units to be dedicated to folks who are exiting homelessness.
And Sarah, before we let you go, I want to ask about the case before the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday. It's about local governments and whether they can charge people with a crime for sleeping outside. Some states have passed bans on this. How do you think about the case and its implications?
I think that it's complex. Best practice dictates that we don't remove camps unless we have shelter opportunities for folks. And there's a lot more kind of beneath the surface on that, right? So if the shelter opportunities that we have are not appropriate fits for people or don't accept people as they are, then simply providing a bed in a space isn't an adequate offering. Successful shelters, for the most part, are shelters that are full. They're places where people feel safe and welcome and trusted and respected. And so those are the spaces that we need to create for people.
Yeah. Now, if Burlington did what some other local governments do and charge homeless people with a crime for sleeping in public, what would happen to them?
With the lower vacancy rate, landlords can be really choosy in who they choose to rent to. And the more barriers that folks have to being able to access housing, including criminal charges, are strike against them when it comes to accessing housing. Additionally, we cannot criminalize poverty. And I think that some of the bans that are really inhumane when it comes to, you know, where we are criminalizing poverty, it's such an inequity for folks who don't have a place to live.
Yeah. Sarah Russell in Burlington, Vermont, is the city's special assistant to end homelessness. Sarah, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's zoom west now to California, which has one of the highest rates of homelessness as well. Bakersfield in South Central California is facing its own challenges. 4 years ago, its chronically homeless population was defined as functionally zero. Now the number is up to 1,700. We have with us Christian Clegg, city manager of Bakersfield. Christian, welcome.
Hello, nice to be here.
So between 2017 and 2020, Bakersfield made big strides in eliminating homelessness. What worked?
It was a variety of factors. You don't get at homelessness with any one thing, but in particular, working with a collaborative of different partners was a big piece, as well as increasing the number of our emergency shelter beds, and then also offering a variety of new service programs and outreach programs, and frankly, also programs that get at addressing the impacts of homelessness on the community, such as, you know, cleanup crews and outreach crews.
Yeah. So as you're describing the suite of many policy options, the homeless numbers went up in Bakersfield after the first year of the pandemic. Are you facing new kinds of challenges now?
We are. That continues to be a big challenge. We are seeing what we believe to be system challenges around mental health and also substance use. The answers to those challenges feel to be the same as we've been having, but the inflow continues to be a higher number than we've experienced historically.
So do you mean you're coming across more persons who are homeless who have mental health challenges than before?
Correct.
Right now, does Bakersfield have enough shelter space? Does it have enough affordable housing units to address this?
Yeah, great question. There is a housing shortage across the state of California. That's not spared Bakersfield either. We do have a shortage of just market rate housing units as well as affordable housing units. And we actually, during the pandemic, doubled the number of shelter beds within our metropolitan community. And it made a very big impact. However, we still have a waiting list of 50 to 60 individuals every week that have expressed a willingness to go into sheltering, and our beds are full.
What happens if there's not enough shelter space? Are there encampments that the city will go in and clear out?
Yes, and it's a delicate balance because we understand that, you know, without as many beds as we would like, folks still need some place to go. But also, we don't want to have encampments in front of businesses, in front of schools, in front of private residences. And so we do have outreach teams that go and contact every encampment, offer them services, offer them beds as available, also offer them access to safe campsites where they can camp. And then if they don't want to go to any of those services, we do provide them a notice that they have to vacate. But we start with the service first and outreach first model. But then we are protecting our public rights of way and our private businesses from the impacts of homelessness. Mm.
And this goes to a central question, as you know, before the Supreme Court on Monday. In the case it's taking up, one key question is whether it's legal to criminalize the act of sleeping outside. On one hand, people like Sarah Russell in Burlington, Vermont, say that criminalizes poverty. Others, including Governor Newsom in California, argue these encampments can be a public danger to businesses and residents nearby. What is your view?
The reality is that there are many options for individuals, and we've been tracking very closely our outreach efforts. And initially, we were seeing about a third of individuals saying they did not want help or services. But that number has risen to almost 60% of individuals saying that they simply don't want to go into a shelter or into some kind of other service. And ultimately, it is a societal challenge we have to grapple with. But there's a balance between the collective good and the individual rights of a particular individual. And many individuals with mental health challenges and substance use challenges are not making good decisions on their own behalf. And ultimately, it's not compassionate to leave them in these kind of situations that are not really humane. And it's also having huge impacts in our community. And so my view is that the good of the whole of a community at some point does outweigh those individual choices, that we need to be able to help individuals get to a better situation on their behalf and on behalf of the community, even if it's not their choice.
Christian Clegg is the city manager for Bakersfield, California. Christian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Scott speaks with Jordan Mechner, who has been making video games since the 1980s. You might know his name from the Prince of Persia series, but his latest project is something very different. It's a graphic novel that's part memoir, part World War II drama, and the first time he's explored his own family's history through art. That's after the break.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Summer is for going to the movie theater because it's too hot to stay home. It's for driving with the windows down, listening to your favorite music. It's for stretching out while you're on vacation to gobble up a TV show. For a guide to some of the TV, movies, and music we are most excited about this summer, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Why did Cola Scola write a bonkers, extremely fictionalized play about Mary Todd Lincoln?
Well, you know, it was 2020 and we were all so isolated. I just started doing research. But the truth is, I just thought of it.
We'll talk about that and more on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
The King of the Prince of Persia franchise is tackling a different kind of story. Jordan Mechner was one of the earliest video game pioneers, but his father and his grandfather cut their own paths through the horrors of World War I and then through Europe as the Nazis started rounding up members of their Jewish family. Mechner writes and illustrates his dramatic family history in Replay, Memoir of an Uprooted Family. It's a graphic novel of very real events, and Jordan Mechner joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thank you.
You begin this graphic novel with scenes of your grandfather and father trying to get out of Vienna, as you say, after Germany takes Austria before World War II. And then you go into kind of non-linear mode, bouncing between timelines. Your father fleeing the Nazis as a child, your grandfather's youth a generation prior, your own family and career timeline. And I'm curious, why did you choose to tell it that way?
Yeah, and at first I had the idea that, well, I'll do a book about my grandfather's story, and then I'll do a book about my own story making games on the Apple II in the 80s. They kind of merged. At a certain point, I realized that the only way I could really do justice to telling my grandfather's and my father's story was to first tell my own. Mm-hmm. In the course of doing the book, of writing and drawing these pages, I actually became aware of links that I hadn't consciously been aware of.
Oh, wow.
When I started. I mean, probably the most obvious is that I moved to France 8 years ago with my two teenage kids because of a professional opportunity. Mm-hmm. It was to do a new Prince of Persia video game project based in Montpellier in the south of France. And it wasn't until later that I realized that I had replayed in reverse what my grandparents had done a generation earlier in moving their two kids across the Atlantic in the other direction. Of course, they did it to save their family. I did it to make a video game, so it's not comparable. And yet, there was this kind of symmetry, this theme of mirroring.
Yeah. Well, I kept thinking about it as I was reading your graphic novel, Replay. I was also born in New York State. And then for a professional opportunity, a journalism job, I moved my young family to Shanghai and suddenly realized or learned more about that's where my mom was born. It's where her father, my grandfather, was arrested and convicted, sentenced, imprisoned. And I kind of learned that story, and it was kind of being in that place that really catapulted me to want to chase that story. So I understand the impulse a little bit. What I find fascinating, and I want to ask you about, is part of the telling. The colors in the different boxes of the drawings, the boxes where you're telling kind of deep history, right, going back to your grandfather and your father's stories are in black and white and gray. Your own history, is that right, is in yellow boxes. Yeah. But I'm curious how you came up with that idea.
So because Replay is a book of three interweaving timelines, I thought that to make it really clear for the reader, I used sepia to portray my father's and grandfather's memories. That is, these things of the 30s and 40s that I'd been told about. I used blue for my own memories of the 1970s and 80s, you know, making games on the Apple II. And then I used yellow for the present day frame. It kind of makes it easy for the reader at a glance to see where they are. And even just turning the page, you can kind of see, okay, so this is like just a one panel flash forward to the yellow timeline. Or you can see, okay, now we're moving into a sequence that's going to take us into the past.
And you have splashes of red representing the Nazis.
Yeah, I used red for the Nazi flags and then also for a couple of other things during the book, which in France in 1940, when my dad and his young aunt flee the occupied zone to get to Vichy and Nice, where they think they're going to be safe, then when they see the French flag, the tricolor, under Pétain, I used red.
The collaborators.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was really no safer than the Nazi regime. It was just with the French flag instead of with the swastika.
Yeah. It's too bad we're on the radio because it's such a visual experience that readers will get. You, of course, are known in your career as a video game maker, designer for Prince of Persia and Karateka. I guess there are several ways to say that. These are landmark games from the 1980s. And your family has been part of the creation. I understand you filmed your father and your brother to create the animations for the main characters to make them look lifelike.
That's right. They were my first rotoscope models for Karateka and for Prince of Persia.
But here in Replay, this is the first time you've drawn your family as your family. And, you know, it is by definition very personal. Why the decision in this project to go so personal with yourself and your family history?
I mean, Replay is really a first for me in many ways. I mean, it's the first autobiographical personal story that I've told about my family. It's also the first time that I've drawn a book as well as writing it. Over the last 15 years, you know, I started writing graphic novels in collaboration with artists. And seeing what they did really reawakened in me the desire to draw myself. I used to draw comics as a kid, basically up until age 12 when I got interested in programming. And I kind of stopped drawing comics for about 4 decades.
Oh,
and it was really a return to a kind of a more personal and intimate form of expression. You know, there's something about a blank piece of paper with pen in hand and having the creative freedom to experiment and to draw something. It actually took me back to programming games in the 80s, you know, because it was almost a solitary, artisanal kind of work as opposed to working with teams and having meetings
Lonelier.
And talking about things.
Yeah, creative project. I can understand that. Forgive me for the rest of us. What is rotoscoping?
So rotoscoping is a technique that animators have used, going back to 1915, Max Fleischer, the creator of Popeye, actually patented a device that would take filmed live action and allow him to trace over frame by frame to create frames of animation. And then when those frames are played in sequence, it recreates the illusion of movement. Mm-hmm. And I used it for Karateka and Prince of Persia because, you know, I wanted animation that would be lifelike in those games. Mm-hmm. When you film an actual person, in this case, my brother David, who was 15 years old at the time, I asked him to put on a pair of pajamas and to go out into the parking lot across the street of our high school and just to run and jump and climb. I mean, he wasn't an athlete. He wasn't, you know, a stunt person. So he just kind of did it. And I think sort of the charm and the sort of awkwardness of those movements is, like, if you look at that video today and then you look at the animation of the game, you recognize it right away because it's so personal and human in a way that makes it universal.
Well, speaking of universal, I'm curious how readers have responded so far because, you know, we all have family stories that are different, and yet there are moments in your telling that seem so universal, or at least kind of tap into my own story. There is one instance where you, is it your father, and he is trying to get on a boat to come to North America. Tell me if I have this right. And then he and his relative, they miss one, and they get on the next one, and they realize the original boat that they didn't get on, it would have been tragic, right? I was there.
It ran into a typhoon, and there was, you know, an epidemic broke out on board. Yeah.
Yeah. And boy, my dad, as he was a young child leaving China ahead of the communists, they missed one boat out of Shanghai, and then they got on the next one. And when they got to northern Taiwan, they learned that the first one sank. I mean, those moments. Do you talk to readers who say, you know, your story is specific and yet so universal?
I've heard versions of that from so many people. You know, the book was published first in France. So even though it was just released a couple of weeks ago in English, for the last 8 months, I've been talking to readers in France and, you know, who come from different countries. And over, I've heard people say that it reminded them of their own family story. Every story is specific. The details are specific. But I think many of us who are children of immigrants, you know, of people who've lived through an upheaval, hear these stories of incredible luck, you know, and survival. And of course, we're here as the product of that luck.
Yeah, yeah. And there's an impulse in you. You kind of frame yourself as someone who gathers, has a lot of boxes of things, family, mementos, etc. You're the gatherer, yeah?
Yeah, I do have a tendency to keep old floppy disks with source code and game development notes and things like that. I kind of made the connection for the first time because my grandfather, when he retired as a doctor in Brooklyn, he spent 3 years of retirement writing a family autobiography. I mean, just for the family, he typed like 1,000 pages of his recollections with photos and documents. And it was only in doing Replay that it occurred to me that in a way I had kind of taken on that responsibility, almost as if he had passed the baton. Mm-hmm. But I think this feeling of obligation to testify, to bear witness, I think he brought that as someone who had survived the First and Second World Wars and wanted the next generation to know what the family had survived.
Finally, Jordan, this book is one that delves into your own Jewish heritage, a heritage that kind of divides your children. Your daughter calls herself half-Jewish. Your son says he does not consider himself Jewish at all. We're talking in the middle of a horrific war all the way around. How do you think in this moment about Jewish identity?
It's interesting. You know, even in my own family, my father and, you know, his parents in Vienna in the 1930s considered themselves Austrian, you know, assimilated Jews. That is, it was their culture, it was their heritage, but, you know, they weren't religious. They didn't go to synagogue. But then for Hitler and the Nazis, like, you didn't have the choice to decide if you felt Jewish or not. You know, they passed the, you know, the Nuremberg laws, which defined what was meant to be Jewish on, you know, on a racial basis. And then France instituted those laws as well. And I think perhaps partly because of that heritage, I'm kind of allergic to anybody trying to tell me or anybody like what we are. I kind of like to be able, and, you know, I'm American, you know, I live in France. I'm from New York. I grew up in Los Angeles. So I kind of treasure the freedom to decide for myself how I want to identify. And So, you know, if someone says, well, you're not Jewish because, you know, your mother wasn't Jewish, or you are Jewish because, you know, two of your grandparents, you know, makes the hairs stand up on the back of my neck a little bit. I feel like it's a basic human right to be able to decide who you are and who you want to identify with and how.
Yeah. And as far as who you are, you know, this project, did it change you or help to fill out your own sense of who you are?
Yeah, very much. You know, I think like a lot of children of immigrants, you know, I grew up with the feeling that there was kind of something behind my own life. Like there was like a previous chapter that I hadn't been there for, and I knew certain things about it, but there were also a lot of things about it that I just, you know, couldn't picture. And which is, as you said about like going back to Shanghai for the first time, it's, I think, you know, the combination of moving back to France, of being in France, being in Europe, kind of on the ground where my dad had been a refugee, where his life had been in danger, where all of these things happened. And then also doing the research to write and draw this book, you know, interviewing my dad in more detail and then speaking to historians and, you know, doing research to be able to draw these things correctly and to picture them, it all became so much more concrete. And things that I'd heard about as a kid, you know, that my dad had told me or that my grandparents had said, that I, you know, I heard them say it, but I couldn't quite picture it. Now, having had to draw the book, I think enabled me to picture it and also to project myself into those scenes in my own imagination in such a way that made it all that much more vivid.
Key features of your video game overlap with your own discoveries, I gather, over your own family history, your kind of treasured family story. I mean, in the course of doing this, are there some spooky coincidences you come across?
Absolutely. In some way, Prince of Persia games have always been about time. You know, from the first game that had an hourglass, you have to rescue the princess before the sands in the hourglass run out. And then, of course, for the Sands of Time, we had a larger hourglass and then this magical dagger that can turn back time. And, you know, time powers and time running in unexpected directions is, you know, a major element in many of the Prince of Persia games. And replay, of course, is interwoven timelines, mm-hmm, kind of jump back and forth between past, you know, and remote past and present. Some things happened in the course of writing and drawing this book that I honestly can't quite explain in terms of simple cause and effect. It almost feels like the past is present somehow. Time is flowing in both directions simultaneously.
Jordan Mechner is creator of Prince of Persia, and his graphic novel is called Replay, Memoir of an Uprooted Family. Great read, Jordan. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much.
That'll do it for us. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Shirley Jihad, Sam Rapelson, and James Mastro Marino. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, Peter O'Dowd, Micaela Rodriguez, Michael Scotto, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend, and we'll be back with you on Monday.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Why is everyone so obsessed with traditional wives or trad wives on social media? This week, we're talking about the viral videos of women making marshmallows and mozzarella from scratch, and how behind the sheen of calm kitchens and cute fits, there's some interesting pessimism about our modern world. And that's worth digging into. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.